If you do an action, right, I cook on Shabbat. I accidentally, you know, I forget it's Shabbos, and I turn on the microwave and I heat up some food. So what is the status of the food? Can I now benefit from that food, benefit from the fact that I heated up the microwave, turn on the microwave? Or is the food somehow forbidden from use due to the fact that I prohibited it, that I violated Shabbat? That's the question we'll be dealing with tonight. So the topic begins, I'll share my screen, I'll send some sources. For the most part, the sources are in Hebrew, primarily because it's just hard to find translations and just be a lot of work. But do not worry, because it really doesn't matter if you can't, if you, this shirim are not particularly textual based. They're really more conceptual. So even if you don't follow along about the text itself, don't worry about it. I'll translate as I go along. But what matters more is the words I'm saying out loud and less the text itself. All right, let me share a screen. All right, you should now all see my screen. Yeah, okay. So the Gemara in Chulin says as follows. Ditnan, hamevashel b'Shabbat. If someone cooks on Shabbat, b'shogeg, if it's accidental, so yochal, so then according to the first opinion of Rabbi Meir, then you can eat it right away, right? There's no penalty for having done something accidental. Obviously, you're chayav korban for doing something wrong, but the food itself, the byproduct, is fully permitted. But mezid, if you do it on purpose, though, intentionally, I decide to cook on Shabbat, then lo yochal, I can't eat it at all, meaning I have to wait till after Shabbos to be able to eat it, right? So if I cook, if I decide to, you know, heat some pot, cook some pasta on Shabbos, if I do it accidentally, I can eat it right away. If not, I have to wait till after Shabbos, and then I can eat, you know, my, at this point, cold pasta that's cooked. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, v'shogeg yochal b'motzei Shabbat. If I do it accidentally, so then, I have to wait till after Motzei Shabbat, but I can eat it right away Motzei Shabbat. Then mezid lo yochal olamit. But if I do it intentionally, then I cannot eat the food at all, ever. It is prohibited to me forever, right? The food is always going to be prohibited. Rabbi Yochanan Sandlar Omer. Rabbi Yochanan Sandlar has a third opinion, his most stringent. B'shogeg, if I do it accidentally, then yochal Motzei Shabbat la'acherim v'lo lo. Then I can eat the food on Motzei Shabbat. Other people can benefit from that food, but not me. And then, right, I'm prohibited from it, but not that. But other people can eat it right away, but only on Motzei Shabbat. B'mezid, if I do it intentionally, so lo yochal olamit, lo lo v'lo achirim. If I do it intentionally, then it's forbidden for all people, both now and forever. Okay? So I gave a little chart just to give a sense of, like, exactly what's happening here. Pretty much they go in, like, each person kind of takes on the stringency of the path. Remeir is the most mako, so just like a little chart summarizing it. B'shogeg, unintentionally, you're allowed to eat immediately, even on Shabbat. But unintentionally, b'mezid, it's forbidden on Shabbat, but it's mutter Motzei Shabbat. Rabbi Yehuda effectively takes, like, the last opinion, like this part, and kind of, like, each part of these kind of get moved, is what Tosa points out. Each part of these kind of get moved to the next category, if you will. So Rabbi Yehuda says b'shogeg is what Rabbi Meir has been mazid was. So b'shogeg is permitted on Motzei Shabbat. It's forbidden on Shabbat, but it's permitted right after Shabbat. B'mezid intentionally, it's forbidden forever, but it's permitted for everyone else, even on Motzei Shabbat. And Rabbi Yochanan Sandlar said b'shogeg is forbidden forever for you, permitted for everyone else, Motzei Shabbat. And b'mezid, if I do it intentionally, it's forbidden for everyone. All right, it's a lot to remember, it's a lot to carry. There's a lot of moving parts here. I'm aware. What I want to talk about though is why, like, what exactly is this machloket between his opinions? Like, why is it that if I the byproduct of my action, which is forbidden, right? Why should it be either permitted? Why should it be forbidden? If it's only permitted in the Motzei Shabbat, why should it matter? Like, how do we understand these opinions? What are they arguing about? And really, I think what that question gets to is really, what is actually the nature of this knas, this prohibition that you're not allowed to eat the food or the byproduct of a malacha on Shabbat, is a derabbanan prohibition. It's a knas. It's a penalty that the rabbis instituted. It's not something that is deraita. It's not something that the Torah institutes itself. It's something which the rabbis created. And the question is, like, what is the nature of that prohibition? Why did they create the prohibition, and how do we understand what its purpose is? So I think that the best way to understand and to really approach this topic is by comparing it to the penal code and comparing it to the understanding, to the theories behind punishment in general, right? And if I commit a crime, right, I kill someone, you know, Kasa Shaw, right? So the penalty that I receive, the crime, the way that the government of America would punish me, so to speak, right, whether it be the death penalty or whether it be, you know, life sentence on parole, what is the nature of that punishment? So there are two main schools of thought within like the two main philosophical understandings of punishments. One is that when I punish someone, let's say I give someone a death penalty for murder. So what death penalty is actually it's a deterrent, right? I am punishing someone really strictly because what I really want to do is to deter him and deter potentially, you know, everyone else in society from ever committing the same crime, right? That's, so to speak, the model of like tough on crime. It's that if we create such high barriers of punishment, so then no one's going to ever want to commit the crime again, right? If my penalty for killing someone is I get killed myself, I'm going to think twice before I kill someone. That's kind of the first theory of punishment. It's a form of deterrence. The second theory, which is almost diametrically opposed, is that when you punish someone for having committed a crime, it's because they deserve the punishment. It's retributive, if you will. It's retribution for what they did wrong. They committed a crime, and now they deserve what they get. If I kill someone, I deserve, you know, a life sentence, or I deserve a death penalty, whatever your argument be on, you know, death penalties. The punishment fits the crime, right? So you have these two models. Then you have what's called the retributive model, the model where I deserve what I get, and you have the deterrent model, where I don't necessarily deserve it. I didn't necessarily do anything so wrong in and of itself, but I'm being punished because society wants to prevent this action from happening again. It's a utilitarian, consequentialist type of theory. We don't want this action happening again, so we're going to penalize you to prevent it from happening again in the future. All right, everyone clear with that so far? So when it comes to Maaseh Shabbat, having done an action on Shabbat, we can understand the opinions presented using that same modeling. For Rabbi Meir, right? If you think about Rabbi Meir distinguishes between what he shogeg, or unintentional actions, and mezid, intentional actions. Where shogeg, he said, is permitted right away, but mezid, if you do it intentionally, then you are punished and you have to wait until after Moshe Shabbat. That distinction between punishing someone whether only for if they did something intentionally, but if they didn't do something intentionally, then we're not punishing them, suggests that this form of punishment, this form of consequentialism, is based on the fact that they actually did something wrong, right? So we're only going to punish them if they did something wrong, if it was intentional. If, though, Rabbi Meir believed in a deterrent type of theory, so then Rabbi Meir, it wouldn't make sense to differentiate so much between shogeg and mezid. You could easily argue that even if I do something unintentionally, we would still be motivated to deter you from doing it in the future, right? Which is perhaps what Rabbi Yehuda's position is, as in, it could be you did anything wrong, like you were accidental. I accidentally, you know, forgot it was Shabbat today, and I decided to turn on the stove without thinking about it. But if we don't deter you from if we don't punish you in some way, if we don't, you know, forbid the food you did, what we're worried about is that you're going to do it again, right? What's going to prevent you from doing the same mistake a second time, or a third time, or a fourth time? So to prevent you from doing it again and again, we have to make some type of deterrence, prevent you have some type of punishment, if you will. So that's what Rabbi Yehuda believes, that we forbid the food on Shabbat, but we permit it on Motzei Shabbat. Now, if you do it intentionally, Rabbi Yehuda's argument is, we're going to have to create even more of a higher level of deterrence. We're going to have to forbid it forever, because if you don't forbid it forever, then you might be motivated to, you know, keep doing it. It's not sufficient. It's not enough to just permit it on Motzei Shabbat. You have to forbid it forever. Rabbi Meir, though, because from the very fact he differentiates to such a large extent between shogeg and mezid, where if I unintentionally cook on Shabbat, it's permitted to me, that suggests that really what Mayer's focusing on is not deterrence, but really whether you did something wrong, whether there is something actually changing in the object itself, whether in more technical terms, what we call this is there an isur hana'a in the object? Does the forbidden food, I cook, you know, pasta, go back to my previous example, does the food itself become prohibited to me, right? Because I did something wrong, I made an isur, if you will. Like I created an isur hana'a. So that isur hana'a only is created if the malacha was done intentionally, Rimeir argues, but if it was done unintentionally, b'shogeg, so then there's no isur hana'a created, there's no actual prohibition inherent within the object, and it is forbidden, and it's permitted to me to eat it right away. Is that distinction clear? And then effectively, my argument, if you look at the chart, I suggest, is that Rabbi Meir follows a retributive modeling where the punishment fits the crime. If the crime was intentional, you get punished and you can't eat on Shabbat. If the crime was unintentional, then you will not get punished. Or Rabbi Yehuda thinks what we care about is deterrence, and therefore, either way, we still have to deter you from doing it again, and it's going to be forbidden on Shabbat. Now, the third opinion, Rabbi Yochanan Tantlar, is a little bit more complicated, but it's worth mentioning briefly, even though I don't want to dwell on it, because I think it opens up this third possibility, which is just worth exploring for a second, introducing, which is even within the deterrent theory, right? If I am given the death penalty for committing murder. So there are two different ways of looking at deterrence. One is what's called specific deterrence, which is that I want to deter this person from ever committing the crime again. So for instance, right, if the punishment for murder is a life sentence, so that's going to deter me, the person who actually committed the crime, from ever doing it again. I mean, I'm never going to be able to do the crime again. So that's really deterring me from doing it again. But the second modeling of deterrence is what's called general deterrence, which is it doesn't deter just me, but it deters society as a whole. Because what we're really interested in is not deterring this specific person, but we want to deter all forms of this crime committed by any person in society, right? So for instance, to give an example that differentiates really well between specific deterrence and general deterrence, if you give someone the death penalty for committing murder, so at that point, it's not really a specific deterrence since the person is dead. There's no way they're ever going to commit murder again. It's not really deterring them. I mean, they're dead. There's nothing to do. But what the death penalty does do, though, is it deters the rest of society from ever committing murder. Because now that this one person has such a severe punishment, no one else is ever going to want to commit murder. Okay, so what you could suggest, and the reason I didn't put it in the chart is because actually the Gemara is explicit. This is not Rabbi Yochanan Sandler's reasoning. He actually has a Gzeirat HaKatuv. There's a pasuk that explains that he relies on. But what you could have suggested was that Rabbi Yochanan Sandler, who differentiates between punishments in shogeg, punishments which affect the individual, that particular individual who committed the crime, versus whether the item is permissible to everyone else in society. You could have suggested that his idea is that he believes in what's called general deterrence. I don't want to really go into so much because it's really a theoretical discussion regarding Yochanan Sandler, but I wanted to really to introduce a second possibility within deterrence itself. So what we have then is there's two models of punishment for understanding Masta Shabbat. There's retributive. And there's deterrence. Within deterrent, it kind of splits up between specific deterrence, meaning deterrence for the specific person, individual who committed the crime, committed the aver, if you will, of cooking on Shabbat, and general deterrence, which is going to deter the whole society from ever committing this aver, from ever cooking on Shabbat. All right. I want to give a bunch of other instances, other, dinim, that relate to Mevashah b'Shabbat, someone who cooks on Shabbat, that kind of illustrate the same principles at play. That when we discuss and we think about Maaseh Shabbat, these two models are what's going to be on our minds. Whether or not we're talking about retributive punishment, or whether we're talking about a deterrent model of punishment for having cooked on Shabbat. Okay, so one discussion that relates to this is discussion about whether or not when you we end the passing like Rabbi Yehuda, that you have to wait, that if you ever cook on Shabbat, it's automatically usher for sure until all of Shabbat, and it's only going to be mutter on Motzei Shabbat. Right? That's Rabbi Yehuda's belief. Shogeg, it's definitely only both b'shogeg and b'mezid. The difference for Rabbi Yehuda is that it's permitted if it's b'shogeg right after Shabbat, but b'mezid, it's forbidden forever for you and permitted for everyone else. The discussion the post can have is within Rabbi Yehuda's position, when we say it's permitted Motzei Shabbat, does that mean it's permitted right away, as in the second Motzei Shabbat ends, right, the second the three stars come out, right away permitted to, you know, benefit from that food, to eat the food? Or do we have to wait to what's called Bichdei Shiyasu, the time it would take for you to have done the same action? So, for instance, if I, cook pasta accidentally on Shabbat, can I now eat the pasta right away, right, the second the three stars come out? Or do I have to wait the 10, 15 minutes it would have taken me to have cooked the pasta after Shabbat to be able to use that pasta? All right, that's like the discussion the Achronim have. So if you look at source two, the Beit Yosef quotes that he thinks that you don't have to wait b'chdei shiyasu, you don't have to wait the time of the taking to do the malacha. You can eat, benefit from the item that you did the malacha with right away. You don't have to wait. And he explains why, right? Umashikav Rabbeinu ain't sarach lahamtin b'chdei shiyasu, you don't have to wait. V'taima, mishum, the lo mashikinim b'chdei shiyasu, ela b'davar she'enu nase al yidei Yisrael, mishum demitoch shekal beinav, yavo lasot kein pam acheret, aval davar she'osei b'Yisrael b'yadayim, what he argues is the reason you don't have to wait is because you're not going to do it again. Only something, once you're already waiting, we're not concerned that you're going to want to do it again so quickly. There's no need to wait. In his modeling, Beit Yosef, he's almost explicit that what matters, the reason you're being punished is we want to deter you from doing it again. So it's enough to deter you, they have to wait till after Motzei Shabbat, right? I'm not going to want to make pasta on Shabbos if I'm going to have to wait till after Motzei Shabbos to eat it. Like, why would I want to make pasta so early? Like, it doesn't taste good when it's cold or it's not fresh. So I don't need to wait the B'chdei Shiyasu to get punished for that extra amount of time it would take me to make the pasta. As opposed to, though, he points to Rashi and other Rishonim who disagree. And if you look at Rashi in the Gemara and Chulin, why is it that he used to wait b'chdei shiyasu for Rashi? So his argument is, it would be inan b'chdei shiyasu, the lo nimte hana'a me'avera, because we want to prevent you from getting any hana'a from the avera. We want to prevent you from getting any benefit from what you did. So Rashi's argument is that it's true that I made pasta on Shabbos, and I have to wait till after Shabbos to use it. But if I can use it, if I can eat the pasta right away, so yes, I was penalized, if you will, that I couldn't eat it, you know, on Shabbos, but I still do benefit, because either way, I wasn't allowed to make pasta on Shabbos, right? No matter what, I can't make pasta on Shabbos. The only, if I wanted to eat pasta on Motzei Shabbos, though, I would have had to wait 15 minutes, you know, to make the pasta. So now, though, that I can eat the pasta right away, right, that would be a potential benefit that I'm getting, that I'm accruing from this pasta. Right, from this malacha, from this action I did on Shabbos. So Rashi's argument is, therefore, you have to wait till after Shabbos ends, not only right away, but the time it would have taken to the malacha, so that no matter what, you benefited nothing from the malacha itself. You gained zero. Because I could have just made, during that time span in which I was waiting, I could have made the pasta myself. So, in other words, while Rashi is concerned for the hana'a, for the benefit you got from it, from the item, and therefore requires you a b'chdei shiyasu, the amount of time it would take you to make the item, the Beit Yosef quotes a bunch of Rishonim who argue, we're not worried about the benefit, we're worried about deterring you, and therefore you're allowed to eat it from it directly. Beit Yosef, in other words, it focuses on a deterrence model, and deterrence happens no matter what, as long as you have to wait till after Shabbos. And for Rashi, he's focusing on a retributive model, because we want to make sure that you don't gain anything from this crime. We want to make sure that you're punished, if you will, for what you did wrong. Okay, so that's like another instance where the same modeling comes up. I'll give another example of the same principle is the Bir Halacha, the Mishnah Berurah. He suggests that it depends on what malacha you did. If usually, if I, you know, bake pasta on Shabbos, so if I cook pasta on Shabbos, so I can eat the pasta on Motzei Shabbos, there's no problem, that's Rabbi Yehuda Tzak if I do it accidentally. However, he points out, if I do a malacha, which takes so long for it to finish, that nobody's going to notice the penalty. So then, right, what have you done? If I cook pasta on Shabbos, so I'm penalized that I can't eat the pasta now on Shabbos. I have to wait till after Shabbos, right? The penalty is clear to everyone, right? Everyone at my Shabbos table sees that I'm penalized, that I did something wrong, and I have to wait. But if I, for instance, this is the example he gives, if I plant a tree, right? So I'm not going to be able to benefit from the tree for, you know, for at least a few days, or for at least a few days, if not, you know, months. So how did the penalty of waiting till after Shabbos affect me? Right? It doesn't affect me at all. I have no penalty, there's no problem for anything I did wrong. Like I planted the tree, but now I'm going to be able to benefit for years without any penalty that's noticeable to the outside. So the Be'er Halacha suggests that based on that problem, actually, if you, for instance, plant a tree, then sarich lakor netiyah, you'd have to actually uproot the tree. Because in his view, what matters is the general perception of everyone around you. Everyone around you, do they notice that you were being punished, that you were, in effect, deterred from committing your crime? Because in his view, what matters is not whether or not you are punished because the punishment fits the crime, whether because it's retributive. It's not the specific deterrence because you yourself know that you're punished. But what matters is whether everyone else around you is punished, whether or not, if there will, there is a general deterrence. And for things which there is no clear general deterrence, then the halacha is they're going to have to actually do something so clear and explicit that everyone notices that you're punished. So if I plant the tree, I have to uproot the tree so that everyone realizes that I'm being punished for what I did wrong. All right, so far, clear so far. If you have any questions or comments, feel free. Oh, I did get something. Let's see. Someone asked if you make the pasta right before Shabbos ends, right, so you wouldn't really have the turn to Prince Beit Yosef. Kind of. It's like that would be the, I guess it would be the extreme case, but it's certainly like a, it's like, yeah, I guess it would be a flaw sort of thing within the deterrent theory. But, but that would be true to some extent. I guess that, yeah. All right. Feel free. Yeah. Perfect question. Great question. Because you know what? It's the exact next topic. All right. I'll ask the question a little bit differently. I think it's what you mean, but I'm gonna present it from a different angle, but it's the same for that question, which is what if I ask someone else to cook for me? So alternatively, something exactly what Jeff asks is what if, you know, a restaurant, you know, cooks for people, right? So this is very common, right? You'll have a Jewish-owned restaurant. It's not a particularly from Jew. They're not particularly religious or, you know, observant. So, and they cook on Shabbos, you know, and they're cooking for Jewish customers. Like, what is the status of that food? So the Magen Avraham suggests, he has a little bit of a discussion. This is source 7. We're supposed to end at 9:40, so about 40 minutes or 45 or something like that. I'm not going to read too many sources inside, but you can see them as I follow along if you want to read them. But the Magen Avraham suggests, he debates within himself whether or not you'd be punished. Whether or not if someone cooks for you, is that the equivalent of me cooking for myself? So he first suggests yes, and then he suggests maybe not. And if you look at, if you think about it, right, based on what we've suggested so far, so if the problem for doing some, for cooking on Shabbos, and the punishment, so to speak, is a retributive model where you're going to, well, you did something inherently wrong and therefore, the punishment fits the crime. So it shouldn't really matter whether or not someone cooked for you or whether or not someone cooked for themselves, right? As long as they cooked, that should be what matters. The very fact that they cooked, you know, and it's prohibited for them to cook, that's what all that matters, and it should make a difference. So, of course, if they cook for you, that should be a problem. But according to the other view, which is the deterrence theory, so then there's more to talk about, because the question then becomes, like, who are we looking to deter? Are we looking to deter the specific individual who cooked, or are we looking to deter the individual who was cooked for, right? If I am, like, the customer, or I'm, you know, a guest at a Shabbos table, are we looking to deter the guest because we want to prevent the guest from ever going to a situation where he causes someone else to do a malacha? So that's a little bit part of the discussion that's going to happen. And in fact, if you look at source 8, the Ketav Sofer, this is the Chatam Sofer's son, has a tshuva where he has a big debate as to whether or not whose kavana matters, right? So we talk about there's a distinction between what's called shogeg and nezid, intentional or unintentional cooking. And he asks, like, whose kavana, whose intentionality matters? Does it matter the person who's being cooked for, or does it matter the person who's doing the cooking? And he suggests, he goes back and forth, and he suggests there's definitely going to be the guy who's being cooked for. Definitely the guest, if you will, or the client, the customer at the restaurant. And if you look at his general logic, the reason he suggests that is because in his view, it's clear that this is meant to be some type of deterrent. We're trying to deter the person we want to deter this malacha being done in the future and from me accruing any benefit from it. So in his view, it's almost a general deterrent. We want to deter anyone involved. So therefore, in his view, we're clearly interested in deterring the person who's being cooked for. And that way we're going to prevent everyone from ever being involved or wanting someone to cook for them. Right, but he has like a whole truth on it, and it becomes really what I call almost a landmark discussion, because this question really does come up a lot. And I don't want to simplify it, because it's more complicated than these truvas. I mean, if this came up, there's more to talk about. But it's a really big question. Eating from like restaurants that are open on Shabbos that are owned by Jews, obviously if they're owned by non-Jews and they're making food for non-Jews, it's a bit different discussion. But food that's made for Jews on a consistent basis on Shabbos, right? Can you benefit from it? Not only on Shabbos can you benefit from it, but can you benefit from it after Shabbos, right? Can I go to a kosher owned donut store on Moshe Shabbos that if the donuts are made on Shabbos, right? Can I benefit from that, from those donuts? So it really becomes a big question. And it'll determine a little bit based on these models, right? If you think that if it's about retributive, then it really doesn't matter like who the donuts were made for, automatically, right? The fact that a Jewish person did something wrong, that should create a problem. The counter argument might be that the Jew, like, who the restaurant owner, might not really be a religious, might be what's called like a tinok shenishba. He might be someone who's like almost halachically doesn't really consider to be like aware of his Jewishness, and therefore he did nothing wrong, and there is no problem, and maybe therefore he would be able to eat the donuts after Shabbos. But if it's about deterrence, so then we're always interested in deterring people from committing malachos. We don't want anyone to ever, cause someone to commit a malacha on Shabbos. So it shouldn't necessarily matter on the status of the baker, whether the baker is religious or non-religious. Either way, we might be interested in deterring them and really all society from ever cooking on Shabbos. Does that answer your question, Jeff? Right, exactly. And then, there's no way we can possibly deter someone who's not interested in following halacha at all. I mean, like, if you're not a religious Jew, like, nothing we can do is ever going to deter you. Like, we're not, you know, unless you're like the police in like Israel or something, and you can throw stones at Bnei Brak, there's nothing we really can do to stop you from doing something wrong. The question is, if you accept the normative halachic practices, and you're willing to accept halacha as a general concept, can halacha then deter you from doing something wrong in the future? That's kind of the question here. I want to talk about two other cases that I think are really illustrative, and I think are really interesting, because they really do come up, not necessarily all the time, but they do come in there, and it really shows something about how we look at these cases. And that is the following. The Chayei Adam makes this concept. I'm discussing this a little theoretical. We'll get to very practical in a second. But the Chayei Adam discusses that, in his view, this concept, this whole discussion about the penalty of having done a malacha on Shabbos, only applies to something what he calls nase mase beguf hadavar. If there's something that's been changed in the item itself, right? So I go back to my example. I cook pasta, right? So originally I had hard pasta full of cellulose that's unedible, and after I cook it, the pasta now it's the cellulose has been cooked. It's now edible. I can now eat the pasta. There's been a clear, noticeable change within the food itself. So only in things or malachot, only in actions. It's not only limited to cooking. It's all malachot, right? Whether it's writing, whether it's borer, whether it's any malacha you can list under 39. Anytime that there's an actual physical change that's done in the item, that's when these rules of Maaseh Shabbat apply. However, he says, aval hamotzi mirshut lirshut shelo nishtane adavar mikamot shehaya. If you do an action, such as I take an object from one place to another place outside, there is no Eruv, and I carry, right, from one place to another. So there's no noticeable change to the item, right? If I take my, I live in a city without an Eruv, and I take my shofar on Rosh Hashanah, on Shabbos, from my house to someone else's house. So I didn't change the shofar, but I did do a malacha, right? I did carrying. So in his view, when you do something that has no effect, no noticeable effect, nothing, no act, no physical or substantive change in the item itself, then we don't follow the regular rules. Rather, we tend to pass him like Rabbi Meir, which means that Shogeg, if he must do it right away, be allowed to use it right away. If it may, he'd be allowed to use it right away after Shabbos. But the rules would be different. Okay, it'd be more permissible. So the question is why, right? How do we understand this opinion of the Chayei Adam? So based on our models, based on the theories we've had so far, if you believe that, if you believe in what I'd call like a retributive model, right, the punishment fits the crime, so then this argument may be possible. You could argue that since I did do something wrong, since the wrong action can't actually be seen, I don't actually get punished. It'd be comparable in some ways to, let's say, I do something wrong. I go to a store and I decide to like steal a shirt. And I take the shirt out of the store, steal it, and then it turns out that actually I was always allowed to take the shirt out because the store was giving free giveaways that day, right? So in terms of the punishment, so maybe I don't really deserve a punishment. I didn't actually do anything wrong. The store was giving me the shirts out for free, so I should be, there's no punishment to be given. However, if we're focused on a deterrence level, so it shouldn't matter whether anything changed to deter you. Either way, I did something. Either way, we're interested in deterring you from the future, because the next time you do it, it might be wrong. The next time I steal that shirt, right, it's actually going to be stolen. I'm actually going to be stealing. It's not going to be, a free giveaway on that particular day. So on a deterrence model, this opinion of the Chayei Adam doesn't really make any sense, or it doesn't fit. The Chayei Adam fits a lot better than when on the retributive model. However, this is important to note. This makes it complicates it a little bit, but it is important to note. And that there is one way you can explain the Chayei Adam even under a deterrence model. And that is to suggest that even the deterrence model believes that we're only going to deter you from doing things wrong if it's noticeable to other people that you did something wrong. If it's not noticeable to other people that you did something wrong, then there's no need to deter you. Because what we're interested in deterring is not you, the specific person who committed the crime, or committed the avera, but society as a whole. So averot that are noticeable to everyone, there we want to deter other people from doing it. So we're going to commit, we're going to punish you and, you know, prevent you from using it. But items, but, or sorry, but averot, which have no discernible, you know, effect, and society cannot be aware that you did anything wrong, those averot, we're not going to deter, we're not going to punish you for, because anyways, there's no need to deter, there's no need, from a societal perspective. Society doesn't need to be deterred from doing it since they don't realize anything was done wrong. Is that clear? So in effect, I'm just summarizing what I said so far, is that this view of the high item, that in cases where you don't create an actual effect, a substantive change in an item, then the rules of Maaseh Shabbat don't apply, and it's primarily, it's permitted if it's b'shogeg, and it's permitted after Shabbat mazid. That principle makes sense under a retributive model, because you didn't actually change anything. And it makes sense under deterrence level if you believe in a general deterrence, and we care about, you know, society as a whole. It doesn't make sense, though, under a specific deterrence, because we want to prevent you from doing that same action no matter what. Now, those two possibilities can be seen, two possibilities, meaning the possible retributive model or the deterrent, the general deterrence level, can be seen within Achronim when they discuss very practical cases. So, two Achronim who are very modern, they both live in, you know, Israel. I think the second one actually died like 10 years ago, pretty recently. But two Achronim who live, recently and discuss cases that are common in Israel. Right. The first case, is, can I fly on an El Al flight, which was prepared, which only flies after Shabbos, but the flight preparations, meaning the giving the food, moving the plane, fueling the tank, all of those things were done on Shabbat. Can I fly on that flight after Shabbos, right away after Shabbos, if it's going to be, right, and thereby benefit, if you will, from the malacha done by Jews on Shabbat? So the Yad Natan suggests that you are permitted because, ain, in his view, shum shinui beguf hamatos hanir al ayin. There is no discernible change to the plane. Yes, the plane is now, you know, fitted to be flown, but me as a customer, when I walk on the plane, I don't actually notice any difference. Like, the plane looks the same before they prepare the plane and after the plane. I don't know, you know, the tank level was in the, you know, was in the airplane. I don't know they did all these mechanical checks in the plane before I got there. And so in his view, what matters is what other people, what society as a whole sees. Because in his view, what the main function of Maaseh Shabbat is to deter society, a general deterrence, and since I can't notice, or people can't notice, any discernible change in the plane, it is therefore permitted. The Minchat Yitzchak has a very similar question, but in his view, he gets a very different reasoning. He says, he talks about a case of buses on Motzei Shabbat, and his question is, can I take a bus that comes to me, you know, right after Shabbos, right after Three Stars End, and there's no way the bus could have gotten to me, you know, unless it, from the original terminal, had it not left on Shabbat. Right? There's no way. So could I benefit from the fact that it came to me? And his suggestion is that, in essence, you cannot benefit, but you can't. But the only thing you have to wait for, the only malachi time you have to wait for, is the kadesh yasu of the gas of the actual spark. Right, every time the engine goes, there's like the combustion of a particular amount of gas that creates a spark and moves the motor forward. So that so I only have to be concerned about the short amount of time, which is, you know, really like milliseconds or seconds after Shabbat, for that particular malacha that was done of the spark and turning on the engine and the combustion. Because in his argument, lefize. Right. The reason I'm now allowed afterwards to use, you know, the bus on Shabbat is because the malacha that was done has now left. It's no longer there. Right? So in other words, if I were to translate that into terms we've been using, what he's arguing is that the malacha is done. I am no longer benefiting from the malacha itself. So when I think about the punishment for this crime, right? I can't benefit from the crime. I can't benefit from what I did wrong, but there's nothing to benefit from anymore, because in his argument, like the bus, the combustion's already gone. It's taking seconds, and now I'm not benefiting from anything. So to summarize then, what Mincha Yitzchak is effectively saying is that what he cares about is the retributive model of malacha, is that you're being punished for what you did wrong, and the reason it's mutter here is because there's nothing that happened, or what happened has now gone away, right? So if you will, for the same question, almost identical question, whether or not I can benefit from a malacha that someone did on Shabbat, right? One with the plane and one with the bus, two diametrically distinct reasonings for why it's mutter. One focuses on whether society notices what was wrong, right? Whether it's near the ayin, it's noticeable for people what's not happening wrong, because they're focused on general deterrence theory. And while the Minchat Yitzchak is focused on not deterrence theory, but actually focused on the Hana'a theory, and what he cares about is the fact that you know the punishment fits the crime. You cannot benefit any Hana'a like Rashi from what you did wrong, and that's exactly what happens here because the malacha has gone away. Any benefit accrued has disappeared in his argument. So I want to end here, focusing on this constant Maaseh Shabbat. There's a lot more to say. I don't want to take too much time since I've already gone a little bit over. But I just want to say that these two models of thinking about punishment, thinking about the consequences of our action, of cooking on Shabbat, of doing any malach on Shabbat, I think are models which are worthwhile just thinking about a little bit as we approach this time of Yom Nirayim, approach this time of seriousness, of tshuva, of, repenting for our sins, repenting for atoning for what we did wrong. And while we're not in charge of ourselves or punishment, and I don't believe we should be in any way, it's worthwhile just thinking about the type of things we do and therefore kind of like what our responses to them are. Because for some things, what we do wrong aren't inherently wrong themselves, but are rather steps which may lead to something worse. Right, it's kind of just deterring us from doing something worse in the future, but they themselves are not inherently wrong, and what we really are focusing to be afraid of is what the worst consequence, the worst thing we could do. While other things, though, the actual thing we're doing wrong, is itself, that's the problem, right? If I talk Lashon Hara, potentially, right, if I slander my friend, so slandering itself is itself problematic. I did something wrong to my friend, and I ruined their reputation in some way. And I just caused something wrong, right, from directly. And, thinking and being aware of what exactly you did wrong is really the first step to how you can start repenting from it. Because without really understanding what you did wrong and why it's wrong, you're going to have a trouble trying to fix it going forward. So I would urge that as we, approach these days, and I know it's still kind of early to thinking about Elul time, really thinking about tshuva, but, as Rosh Hashanah comes and Yom Kippur songs, then we, at some point Yom Kippur, you go through all the al-chaits, all the things you did wrong. It's just worthwhile thinking about what I did wrong. Is it wrong, like inherently wrong, or is it something that's preventing you from doing something worse? And it's important that those deterrents are important. They have value because really that worst thing is really so bad that I really need to do whatever I can to avoid doing those things. So just being aware of these two models, I think, is a useful lens and framework for really being aware of what we do wrong and trying to fix ourselves to whatever way possible. So I leave on that message, and as I said, I hope to meet everyone in person in the near future. And thank you so much. If you have any questions, feel free to ask now, or you can email me, or as you will. Thank you again for everyone for listening.